Okay, great. So let's get started. Excuse me. So there were a few things that I wanted to finish up about decision trees before we go on to the next topic. So this is where we stopped last time. Last time we brought up the issue of overfitting, which was this phenomenon that happens when, as the model grows more complex. So for the case of decision trees, the complexity of a decision tree can be measured by the number of nodes in the tree. We see that the model has more flexibility. So it can do a better job of remembering the training data. So you see this line on training data gets better. But it actually does a worse job of predicting on new data that it wasn't trained on. And in the case of decision trees, we talked about pruning as a way to deal with that. So that's what we talked about here. And so now moving on, so we talked about information gain as a method of selecting which attribute to split on in a decision tree. And we talked about that as being a measure of how pure the examples are that reach the new leaves in terms of the class label. So there are some other measures that you might think about in terms of selecting which attribute you want to use to expand a node in the decision tree. And there's one that's talked about in the book, which is this idea of gain ratio. And what that's designed to do is, sometimes if you have an attribute that has a large number of potential values, maybe for example, if you have you might have like a date in a database record. So each record has a different date. So I mean, if you didn't realize that you had that attribute there, then that would uniquely identify which training instance is which. So if the decision tree learner decided to split on an attribute like that, it would mean every leaf would have exactly one training example, which would be perfectly pure, have zero entropy, and that looks like a great split. So the gain ratio is kind of this kind of heuristic hack that's designed to avoid that problem. And the idea is to compare the information gain. So if I have some attribute A that I'm thinking of splitting, and S is the set of examples, it says, well, let me compare the information gain splitting on this attribute A to what I would expect to get from splitting on some attribute that has C classes. So what this split information up there is, it's the entropy of what I would get of the uniform distribution over examples given that I have C classes. So it's a way of saying in the baseline, if I take this leaf and I split it along an attribute that has C values, what value would I expect to get of the information? And so this is a way of penalizing attributes that have a large number of values. So the last topic that I wanted to talk about was, we talked about decision trees, but sometimes in a data mining context, what you really want to have is a set of rules. So that can be useful for interpretability. So instead of showing, you might see if you get a list of rules out of your decision tree learner, then you could take one of those rules on its own and kind of hand it to a domain expert and say, and ask if it's something that matches their knowledge of the domain. So some of the commercial decision tree learners, what they do is they'll take a tree like this, and then if you go down one set of branches to the leaf, then what you get is a logical formula that looks like this. So what this thing on the bottom says is the outer disjunction. This actually describes the entire tree, sunny, normal. All of the yes instances in the tree are described by this rule. So the outer thing is a disjunction, and then each term is a conjunction. And so this describes all of the positive attributes. And the way that you got this is simply by saying, for all the leaves where the decision attribute was yes, I'll take the path down to there, and I'll make one clause based on that path. So that, excuse me. So, and there are a couple more minor issues that I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on. One thing, as we mentioned before, is that you decision tree learners can very easily handle continuous attributes as well as discrete attributes. And the way you do that is you typically make an axis parallel split. So if you can optimize a split point with respect to information gain in the same way that you would with a discrete attribute, because it only makes sense to put the boundary. If you're trying to decide the value of 72.3 up in the example in the first bullet, it only makes sense to put that between training instances. So you can set up a continuous optimization problem and find the best value of the split point in terms of information gain. And that's described in the textbook. And then something else that I think I did mention last time was that you can use decision trees for regression as well as classification by taking like an average of the training examples at the leaves as opposed to just taking the most probable class. If you wanted to deal with, it turns out there are, and if you're interested, there also are ways to deal with missing data in decision trees. You can see it's not immediately obvious how you would do that, because if you're deciding what point to split, well, what do you do if you have some instances that don't have a value at that node? They still have to go somewhere in the decision tree. And so there's heuristics that people use about that. And the other thing that's interesting is that decision trees do naturally a kind of feature selection, right? If I have a large number of features, and if I am lucky enough that when I train a decision tree, that the tree is small, that means that it must have ignored most of the features. So that's something that it's at least potentially true that decision trees can ignore irrelevant variables. Although in practice, as we've seen, because of their problems with overfitting, if you add an irrelevant variable, it might choose to split on that if it happens to be correlated with one of the class variables. And so the last thing is we've described this algorithm called IE3, which is a good it's a good way of conceptually understanding what decision tree learners do. The ones that people use in practice are a little bit more complicated. So one of the ones that's described in detail in the book that's very popular is this thing called C4.5, and that's essentially a later version of IE3 by the same person, this guy Ross Quinlan. And I think C4.5, I mean, you can actually download the code, you can download an executable for C4.5. And there's also a commercial version of it, which is called C5.0. And then there's also this thing called CART, which is by Leo Breiman, and that kind of emerged independently out of the statistics literature, whereas Ross Quinlan is more of a machine learning guy. So that's basically, that's basically all I have to say about decision trees. It's this kind of greedy algorithm trying to find a reasonably small tree that fits the training data reasonably well. And what you do at each node, you're greedily selecting the next best attribute, typically according to this kind of information gain heuristic, although there are other heuristics that you can use. And they can be, decision trees can have problems with overfitting. And one way to handle this problem is this post-pruning. So I'm going to move on to another topic. So do we have any questions from this lecture, the last lecture about decision trees? Okay, good. Well, then I'll see if I can get through a second set of slides. Yeah. So the second thing I'm going to talk about in this lecture is linear regression. And up until now, we've been talking mostly about classification algorithms. So we've been talking about where the thing we're trying to predict is this discrete class label. And now I want to talk about cases in which the thing that we want to predict is actually the single continuous value. It's a scalar value. So and that's called, in general, that's called the regression problem, where we're trying to predict a real number. So I'm going to assume that the training data is a set of pairs where I have an input vector of features. I'm going to assume that they're all continuous. And their big D is going to be the number of features. Little n is going to be the number of training examples. And I want to predict this one target value, which is a real number. And today we're going to focus on From the name linear regression, you can infer that the relationship between x and y is going to be linear. And so pictorially, what this looks like is that I have a set of points here. The x-axis here is x, the feature value. And the y-axis is, you think this is the training data. And the y-axis is the target value that I've got in the training. So if I'm trying to fit a linear function, basically what that means is I want to find a red line like this that fits the points well. So we're going to talk about what it means to fit the point well, but you can think of this as well-defined, that this curve is the predicted value of y as a function of x, and then each of these blue is the actual one. So I want the distance between the point and the curve, the sum of the distances between the point and the line to be small. So that's a one-dimensional example, but you can think of this in two dimensions as well. Then you get something that looks like this. So this is a system of the Oops, I didn't want to do that, did I? Yeah. Two dimensions, it looks like this. So now I have two features, x1 and x2, and then I get the prediction as a function, and again, the z-axis is, now there's a z-axis, and that's the target. And this, you get the generalization of a line in two dimensions, which is a plane, in general, be a hyperplane. And that's the prediction as a function of the features x1 and x2. And each of those red things are training points. And you can see in this picture, I just take to say, well, how closely does I want to find a plane such that all of those vertical distances of the points in the plane are small. So that's what you're doing in a regression problem. And you can do this with as many features as you want. It just gets harder to put on a slide. So this is what the model looks like in math. So I have a number of features, x1 through xt, and the thing I'm trying to find is a set of weights. And the weights, w0 through wd, such that this f of xw is going to be the prediction of the model, given the inputs x. And it's going to be a linear function of the parameters. There's going to be a lot of linear algebra in this lecture. So rather than writing this big, wheely summation, we can write this in vector notation, has a dot product between two vectors, one of which is w, which is just a vector containing all of the weights. And the other is a vector of all the feature values. And I'm going to write this as phi. I mean, I could just write it as x. But I'm going to write it as phi of x, because it'll help me to generalize later. And all this thing phi is just a vector x with a 1 on the end. And this is just a notational trick, because now I don't have to write w0 plus wt phi. Right? Now I just put a 1 in the vector, and I can write the whole thing as a single dot product. So this is just the notation for how we're going to do prediction according to a linear model. And if I had only one x, then what I'd get would be exactly a single line, as I saw on the first slide. If I had two x1 and x2, I'd get a hyperplane, like on the second slide. So that's what the model is. So there's another way of writing this model. This is actually a way of writing the training objective. So remember I said the training data is going to be a set of vectors x1. It's going to be a set of inputs x and outputs y. So I can assemble all of these inputs into a matrix. And that's the matrix I'm going to call big phi. So each row is one of these phi of x things that I had on the previous slide. So each row corresponds to a training example, and each column corresponds to a feature. So this is an n by d plus 1 matrix. Right, the first thing whenever you see a big matrix equation is, what are the dimensions of everything in the equation, and do they actually add up? So that's the dimension of this guy. And then I can take take all of the outcomes of the training data, and I get this thing y, which also comes from the training data. And that's just this vector of all the targets that I saw in the training data. So now, suppose I take this this matrix phi, which is it's called the design matrix, and suppose I told you the parameters of the model. So I said these things w are the weights of the linear model, and then I take the matrix product of phi and w. That's going to give you this thing that I'm going to call y hat. And what does that mean? It depends. Kind of depends on how long it's been since you've seen linear algebra. But if I take the weight vector and multiply it by phi, what should I get on the basis of the definitions I've given you so far?
Prediction.
Yeah, it's a prediction, right? Because what does it mean to multiply a matrix by a vector? Basically, it means that you get an output that's a vector, and the output is a linear combination of the columns of the matrix. So the first row is just the is just this common vector W, the dot product with the first row, which is exactly what I said on the previous slide, how I make the prediction of on some input x. So this thing y hat is just a vector of predictions on the training data. So it's models predictive values on the training data. And so I actually feel better today. I might sound worse than I did on Thursday, but I actually feel better. So it's one of those reasons. So this matrix notation is basically, it's going to make it easier for us to write the training objective in a couple of slides. Actually, it might be the next slide. No, it's not. So this looks like, so the problem that we have is, okay, I know y hat equals phi times w. I know phi, because those are the training inputs, and I know what y hat should be, because those are the targets that I have in training. So it's like I have this equation y and phi, and I want to solve for w. So it should be really easy, I mean, it is really easy to do training in linear regression, but it seems like it should be super, super easy, right? Because, you know, if we've had linear algebra, this is a linear system of equations that I'm asking you to solve. So you saw in linear algebra how to solve, I mean, if this were a scalar, it'd be easy, right? I just divide both sides by phi. You know, it's not a scalar, but even if it's a matrix, why couldn't I, maybe I can multiply both sides by phi inverse, right? That's how you solve a linear system of equations. And I'll just say W equals phi inverse times Y. Can you, so, and that would be a way to do training of a linear model. Is that right? Can you do that? Okay, so why not? That's right. That is one problem with this. There's in fact another problem, but yeah, that it typically would be, even if that's not a problem, there's another problem, even more basic problem. Yep. Oh, y is the training data. Y is the vector of all the targets in the training data. So you know that. So it's a n by 1 vector. And so w is a set of weights. So if d is the number of features, so w is a d plus 1 column vector. Sorry? That's going to be less of a problem with the linear. It depends, but that's not a problem yet. Yeah.
How do you know whether it is singular or non-singular?
How do you know? So that is a question for the math surgeries. And I'll talk about that in a minute, I think. Ask me that again at the end of this slide. So one problem is that phi isn't even square, right? Right? It's not a thing. The inverse of a matrix, if I take an n by n matrix, the inverse of a matrix is one that I multiply by it, and I've got another n by n matrix, which is the identity matrix. But phi here isn't even square. So if I had something that was, so let me see, I don't have the little thingy that I was hoping to have, but I do have. So y here is n by 1 vector. And then phi is n by d plus 1. And this thing is d plus 1 by 1. So what I need is some matrix. Yeah, so I'm trying to explain. So phi isn't even a square matrix. So what we need is a generalization of the idea of inverse that kind of makes this look like a square, that works in this case, right? So it's conceptually like this, but it's not quite this simple. And the other way of thinking about it, so you talked about whether this matrix was singular or not, and that's the right kind of idea. The intuitive thing that corresponds to that idea is whether the, so if you have a system of linear equations in d variables, so you have this question of, well, is there a single solution or not? And the general rule is, assuming that the equations are linearly independent, you need the same number of equations as variables. Right, you can think of each row as phi as being one equation that places a constraint on W. So typically when people use linear regression, so if you have fewer equations than variables, then the system's under constraint. right? Typically, you haven't said enough about the desired, you haven't given enough equations to give you a unique solution. Whereas if you have the same number of equations as variables, assuming that they're linearly independent, then there is a unique solution. But here, the system is overconstrained, right? So typically, we have more data points than we have parameters when we're doing linear regression. So it's not always the case, and we'll talk that, but that won't happen. That's not going to happen in this lecture. So what that means is, so what does it mean to fit a, if I give you 2 points in 2D, right, you could fit a single line through it, right? And that's basically what you'd be doing with being the first one. But here I'm giving you 5 points and saying fit a line through it. So there's not a unique solution to how do I fit a line through 5 points. Because in general, these points aren't going to be collinear. And that's a consequence of the system being overconstrained. And so one way, if I really believe that in the real world the linear relation is true, which in some sense you probably never do, but why would I see non-collinear points if I think that the model is really linear? Well, one reason that could be is because the data has noise. You're going to hallucinate that really these things came from a line, but I just happen to add noise between those points. So instead of saying, well, I'm going to solve for, so what, just doing the linear algebra solution would be, I want to find the line that exactly goes through all of the points. But that doesn't make sense if you have a situation like this. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to find a way to put a line like this that kind of goes through all the points. And that's what we do in the next slide. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to define something I'm going to call a loss function. So you can basically view this kind of fitting problem as an optimization problem. So I'm going to define a function of these weights w, and we're going to minimize that function with respect to w in order to find the best set of weights. And the way we're going to design that function in such a way that at the minimum, the prediction y hat that we get looks like the y that we had in the training data. And since y is a function of w, that's why this makes sense. So what the loss function is going to do is basically going to be the difference between y hat and y. Right, so there are many things we can choose that says, well, I want y hat to look like y. But we're going to do something, and for mathematical convenience, the loss function that we're going to choose is called squared error. So basically what this is doing is, there's a lot of different ways to write it. Basically, this is saying the sum over all the training points of the true value of the training points, yi, minus the predicted value. And we're going to square it so that they're all positive. Right? If we didn't have the square there, then we actually like to make negative errors, which wouldn't make any sense. And we're going to minimize this thing. So by putting the squared error in there, every error is bad. And so if just substituting in the definition for f, I get the second one, which is saying in the linear model, this is what the squared error looks like. And then the third line is where I'm using this notation of the design difference. So this thing, when we said this thing phi w is the predicted value y hat, and this thing y are the actual values. So this thing y minus phi w is just a vector of length n, which gives me the difference, the difference between the true and the predicted values. And I'm going to say I can write it as being saying the length of this thing on the bottom is the length of this vector. This is the residual vector. So the residual is a term for basically that vertical difference on the second slide. The difference between the true value and the predicted value is called the residual. So that turns out that that's what we're trying to minimize. In order to find the best parameters w. And so, what does this function look like as a function of w? Well, it's a quadratic function, so it's going to look like a parabola. So here, the x-axis and y-axis here are two different weights, and the z-axis is this value of this function o. So it's basically the smooth quadratic curve where, and the minimum is the one, and the minimum is going to represent the line where the sum of all these vertical distances squared is as low as we can make it. Now, so it turns out you can solve this analytically, and the solution is this thing w hat, which is down here. Now, how do you solve this equation? You guys have taken calculus, how do you solve an equation? How do you find the minimum of a function? Yeah, you set the derivative to zero. So that's what you can do here. You can just say this is a multivariate function, so you want to solve for the gradient, for the vector of the partial derivatives. So you can take the partial derivative of this function with respect to, I'm not going to go through the derivation, and you're not going to be expected to go through the derivation on the exam, I think that's right. Yeah. So, but just so you know where it comes from, the what you do is you take the partial derivative of this function with respect to w, with respect to one of the wi's, and then you solve for w and say, well, that should be zero at the minimum, and then you solve for w. And then if you write it back in the matrix notation, then you get that. So so this thing, you can think of this thing as sometimes called pseudo-inverse of phi. One way you can think of this is because it's kind of solving, it's a generalization of solving the linear system of equations that we saw before. So if phi were a square matrix of full rank, then this would just devolve into phi inverse y, just like we saw in, just like you would normally do in linear algebra. But in general, it's not going to be, because you're not going to have exactly the same number of data points as parameters, and so you get this thing instead. And it turns out you never have to remember this equation, because there are plenty of numerical packages that will solve this thing for you. But it's good to know where this comes from. Okay, so there's another way to think about solving. So that's it. That's how we do learning in least squares, right? So when you call like fit linear regression, it just takes that thing using kind of advanced linear methods which are designed to avoid round-off errors, and then it gives you w hat. That's how it does it. It just literally solves it. Well, I don't know if it literally computes that matrix, but it conceptually is doing that thing of computing that matrix. Okay, but there's another way to think about the least squares problem, and this is a different geometric viewpoint. Hopefully you'll find amusing. So this picture up at the top is Rn. So remember n, oh, that should be little n, sorry. But n being the number of data points. So each one of those vectors, x1 and x2, is a column of the design matrix. So this thing, x1, is the first feature value for all the training instances. And then this thing, x2, is the second feature value for all the training instances. So now, if I take any vector of predictions, suppose you gave me a set of weights, and then I gave you back some y-hat, some vector of predictions. That's going to be a linear combination of the columns of the design matrix, because that's what it means to multiply a matrix by a vector. So any possible set of predictions by a linear model is going to be some element of the space that's spanned by the columns of phi, by these vectors x. So that's this yellow thing at the bottom. It's a subspace that contains all possible predictions that could be made by a linear model. Now this thing y is the vector of all possible target vectors. Now that's not going to sit on that space in general, because I mean we don't expect all of our training points to actually be collinear. So this is going to sit somewhere outside of the space. The true value is going to be somewhere outside of the space, typically of what a linear model can represent. So it turns out that you can view what linear regression is doing as a projection of this vector y onto this yellow space. So what does a projection mean? Geometrically, it's very simple. What a projection means, it means find this dotted vector in such a way that the distance, find a dotted vector in this yellow space, such that the distance between the vector y and the dotted vector is as small as possible. That's what it means to do a projection. It means find the closest vector. And so you can think that that's one way of viewing when you solve that matrix equation on the previous slide. It's in some sense finding the prediction vector that the model can represent that's as close as possible to the true target vector. So this is just a geometric way of saying the same thing I said when I presented the objective function for linear regression. And that vertical dashed vector, that's the distance between y and y hat. So that's the residual vector, right? That's the vector of the mistakes that I made in all the training instances. So that's not something you necessarily need to know, but this is kind of, I find this a fun, mind-blowing way, it's not that mind-blowing, of viewing linear regression. Okay, there's another way to view linear regression, and that's a probabilistic interpretation. So up until now, I haven't really made that many assumptions about the input or the output. But sometimes it can be useful to think of regression as being a probabilistic model of the outputs. And that can be useful for various reasons. It can be useful for doing statistical hypothesis testing. And it can also be useful for extending the methods if you want to make a bigger probabilistic model that has linear regression as a subcomponent. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a conditional probability distribution. So I'm going to think of a conditional model of the outputs y given the inputs x. So the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to say, well, the values of y, the true relationship between y and x, is just a simple linear function of w transpose x. But the things I got to observe were corrupted by noise. And epsilon is this noise thing. So I'm going to say these things y, which are the targets that I got to observe, are going to be w transpose x plus epsilon. And in this version of the model, I'll say epsilon is going to be a normal variable, whose mean is 0. And actually, that should say sigma squared, not 1. Sorry about that. Whose mean is zero, and whose variance is sigma squared. So what that means is that y is also a normally distributed random variable. So it means that given that condition on x, the condition on the input, the out condition on some input xi, the output y is also normal, where the mean is wtx, which in the second line is written as f of xi, and the variance is sigma squared. So now, let's think about what would I do. So we talked before about doing maximum likelihood. So we talked about doing maximum, and we've talked about doing maximum likelihood in a Gaussian distribution. So let's see what happens when I write down the Gaussian. So this is now a complete model of the data, right? If you told me the x's, I can now probabilistically generate all of the y's. So let's write down what the likelihood is. So now if I take the log of, say, in this case, the minus one probability of yi given xi, well, the first thing is there's this, if you remember what the Gaussian likelihood is, it is, given some mean sigma, it's 1 over root 2 sigma squared, ESP, this is z minus root. Right, so this is just a Gaussian. So now if I take the log of that, then I get, say, log root 2 sigma comes from this, then log sigma comes from this, the log cancels with the x, and then I get that thing right there. So now if you squint at that, you'll see it looks very familiar. So if I want to minimize this with respect to w, right, so w's over on the right there, well, I don't care about the first term, and I don't care about the second term. They don't affect the minimum at all. Because if I take the derivative of those terms with respect to w, it's 0. So wherever, so if I took those terms out, I have a different value of the likelihood, but the minimum of the likelihood would be in the same place. Because any place that had a 0 derivative before has a 0 derivative now. I just moved the curve upward, but I haven't changed where the minimum is. So I can ignore those first two terms. And in fact, I can also ignore, I'm trying to minimize this thing with respect to w, so I can ignore that constant, 2 sigma squared. Because again, that kind of warps the curve, but it doesn't change where the derivative is 0. So what I'm left with is yi minus f of xi squared. And that was exactly this objective for the least squares. So what that means is that maximizing the likelihood according to this model is the same thing as minimizing the least squares objective of O of W. So this is a probabilistic way of thinking about linear regression. Oh, one thing that I was supposed to mention before, since I just said it, is another term for linear regression is sometimes people refer to linear regression as least squares. The reason for that being that this optimization criterion that I'm minimizing is the sum of a lot of squares. So I'm trying to minimize the squared residuals. So one way of thinking about this is that this linear relation, WTX, under this model, is the expected value of y given x. So you can think of it as saying that that I assume the expectation of y given x is linear, and then the exact distribution is given by that thing up there. This was kind of assuming that I knew sigma squared. Once you're given w, if you wanted to estimate sigma squared, you could do that too, using maximum likelihood. And that would be this thing down at the bottom. Which is just the same thing, which is just look at it. It's like take all of the residuals, y minus f of xi, and then say, what's the empirical standard deviation of those? Okay, so that's kind of linear regression. If we back up, you can think of this as, this is different than the machine learning methods we've seen so far in several different ways. First, the task is different, as we talked about before, than the methods I've seen so far, in that we're dealing with a regression task rather than a classification task. And the other thing that's different, I think, from all of the methods we've seen so far, is that there's a more restricted model structure. So for things like k-nearest neighbor and decision trees, the model structure was very flexible. It can memorize the data in a lot of different ways. But here, the model structure is very restrictive in the sense that I'm only allowed predictions that are linear in the features that I've described. So that can be both an advantage and a disadvantage. It's an advantage and it makes it harder to overfit if I have a less flexible model. But it's a disadvantage in that it's harder to, in that I don't expect the true relationship to be linear most of the time. And then we also talked about, what's our score function? What's our objective for deciding whether a particular model is good or not? And we said that it was either squared error or likelihood, depending on how you want to look at it. And then we also had an optimization method for finding the particular model that had the best value of the score function. And that was just to do calculus, to find the derivatives. So that's kind of a summary of linear regression. There are a couple other issues. So here are some examples. These are kind of more machine learning. Linear regression is kind of the workhorse tool in the social sciences, right? Whenever you see a news article about some social science paper and they say, oh, this has an effect on this, it means we collected some data and ran a linear regression. But it's also can be useful for machine learning types of applications as well. So one example would be that, the different examples here, I won't go through them all. The different kind of forecasting applications are often useful for linear regression. So if I want to forecast the value of a stock, right, there's a very simple model, very simple baseline model is I'll model the value of the stock as kind of a linear function of the past 5 or 10 values of the stock in the previous days. Or you can do the same thing for energy load. Say the value of the current day is going to be is going to be a linear regression based on the past couple of days. There are other kinds of prediction problems staffing prediction problems at help desks, and other kinds of examples on the slide. But it's as you can see, it's such a simple tool that it's very versatile, and it's often kind of the first thing that you want to try. Okay, so there are two caveats. I wanted to bring up if you're actually going to use a linear regression model. The first, that it's well known that linear regression is very sensitive to outliers. So an outlier it's not something that's formally defined, but it's basically a data point that doesn't look much like your other data points. So this is an example with like 6 data points where the first 5 at the bottom I generated from the linear regression model. So that should be really great. And then I added 1 where the value was abnormally high. And the problem is that because you're using squared error, as you get farther and farther away, if you think of just a parabola, as you get farther and farther away from the origin, the amount of penalty that you get for being off gets higher at a very large rate. So you would rather see, so if you're using squared error, you'd rather see 10 mistakes of size 1, right, than 9 points that are perfect and 1 mistake of size 10. Right. So what that means is that one big mistake can have a very large effect on the parameters that you choose. So this green line here, you see that this green line here is the regression line if I ran linear regression on the 5 points that really were generated from the model. If I add this 1 point that's far away, then suddenly the green line becomes the red line. And it's kind of overshooting all of the real points and in an effort to try to do a better job of fitting that 1 point that's outside. Now, why would you expect to have outliers? Well, there could be a lot of reasons. One reason would be that there's a measurement error, right? So if this were from sensor data or something, maybe there's just a flaky sensor on that day. Another possibility is that there's actually 2 things going on in your data set, right? There's one thing, there's this linear relation, and then there's those points, maybe those points are real, but they're just generated, they're just caused by some other factor. So lots of times people will remove outliers in order to get a better estimate of that green line. And that can be a good thing to do, but if you see an outlier and you're tempted to remove it, you always want to understand where that's coming from. So that's the first caveat. And the second caveat is it's useful to do, there are various kinds of graphical diagnostics that I don't have time to go through in detail, but that are useful for checking linear regression models. So one kind of, one diagnostic that's very useful is a plot of the residual by the fitted values. So it's basically a plot for every data point of y versus y hat. And the statistics packages will do that for you automatically. The reason you might want to do that is there are two kinds of obvious problems you can find. You can find one kind of problem is you can see outliers very easily, no matter how many features you have. And the second kind of thing is you look for structure in the residuals, right? So imagine I had a set of points that really are quadratic, and I try to fit a line through them. Then if I just look at the distances between the points in the line, then I'll see that they kind of still look like a parabola. So that might tell me that maybe a linear model isn't good enough for this particular data set. So that's what I have to say about basic linear regression. And there are a couple of enhancements to linear regression that I want to talk about. One kind of thing is, suppose I want to predict a bunch of real numbers rather than a single real number. That's fine. That's called multiple regression instead of, basically what you do is you just have a different weight vector for each dimension and do regression separately. So that's not much of a problem. The other kind of question you can ask is, if you don't believe your data is linear, then what do you do? Well, one thing is you could just throw away linear regression and do something completely different. But an interesting thing is you can actually augment, as we talked about feature processing earlier in the class, you can actually augment the feature space such that in the old set of features, you're fitting this nonlinear function, but in the new set of features, you're still doing linear regression. So, what kinds of features you might want to have into play? Well, maybe you believe that the real function is polynomial in terms of the original features. So then you might, so this plot on the left is the feature function. So this thing on the x-axis is the old value of the feature, and this thing on the y-axis is the new value of the feature. So I might ask things like a parabola or some kind of different kind of polynomial on the basis of the input. And so now I can do quadratic regression or cubic regression or what have you. So that can be a useful trick. You also might want to have something that's more local. So maybe I want to have, we talked about binning before, which was having a feature that says it's one if this continuous value is within a certain range. So I might want a soft version of that, like one of these Gaussians in the middle. So then the output of this feature would be just the density value of the Gaussian at some certain point. And so that would be kind of like in a two-dimensional image, that would almost work like a feature detector. I guess it's using a feature, but in a different sense of vision. But this would be like a little light that goes off whenever the feature value is near that red line. Another kind of thing that could be interesting is sigmoids. So that's kind of like having a hard threshold. It's kind of like, I can imagine a feature that's a hard threshold that says, well, the feature is one if the new feature is one if the old feature was greater than zero. Well, sigmoids give you a soft version of that. It's another thing that can be useful on the right. Now, you can fit these things in exactly the same way as you did a linear regression. So if you had a small number of them, you could even just still use the linear regression package, right? Just add new things onto the feature vector. And if you have a large number, there are more interesting things you can do that I won't get into. And so because of the clever way that we defined the notation on the previous slide, you don't really have to do anything to write the new kind of regression. You just have a design matrix where the rows, instead of being the actual features that I got, are the values of this new feed function on the new data points. And then the solution in this generalized problem is just the same way. So here's an example if you're using polynomials. So if you take the top left, you have a set of points coming from this a sinusoidal curve, right? So if I allow, if I'm forced to be linear, so that's n equals, but then if I'm forced to be constant, that's n equals zero, then I can just remember the mean value of these things. So this green thing is the true thing that generated it, and the red thing is one fit. And so the set of features are going to be these polynomials up to degree m. Each one of these graphs is for a different m. So if I just say, well, I only get one constant, that's the mean. It's not very useful. But when I do linear regression, well, then I get a trend, but it's not really fitting what this thing really is. So now if I give myself cubic functions, then I can fit it fairly well. And then the interesting thing is what happens when I get to n equals 9. Right, so like we were saying before, if I have a problem, if I give myself the same number of parameters as I have data points, then I just revert to doing linear algebra. And I just find a line in this higher dimensional space that goes through all of the data points. And then if I express that back in the space of this one thing x, I
get some really heavy sloping thing that memorized all the data points. And the reason for that is, well, I have nine data points and I have nine parameters.
So I should be able to, in a linear model, I should be able to find a line that fits to all the data points. So that is another example of overfitting.
I mean, unless you expect that, well, here we know the green line generated it.
But even if I hadn't told you the green line generated it,
you could probably guess that most things you would come across in practice don't have that red curve.
So a generalization of this is, or another choice of features, it would give you a radial basis function model.
And that's where you choose one of these localized Gaussians to be your individual feeds. So each one of these things has, each one of these features is a parameter, which is CI is one of them, alpha is the other one.
And so that's, that gives you, that's like the Gaussian feature that I showed two slides ago. And so this it's called a radial basis function when you have a number of these and use those as features to do linear regression. And you know, there are lots of different ways to choose. So then learning corresponds to both the values of the weights on phis, which you just do using linear regression, and then also you can choose the values for C and alpha. And you know, and finding the weights is the same as you ever would. So the other So the other question, if you want to do any of these methods, is, well, how many features do I need? Because as you can imagine, as we've seen, if you have too many, that's really bad. So if you have too few, then you're just doing a linear model. And then if you and if you have too many, you're just going to overfit the training data. So if you have an there are automatic ways of choosing M, and they're not terribly satisfying. We might get into them later in the course. I'm not actually sure. But you might say, well, so everything I've talked about in this lecture doesn't tell you how to choose the basis functions, right? What it says is, given the basis functions, here's how you find the linear weights. So you might say, well, that's not, I mean, that's learning, but it's a little bit, you'd want more than that, right? You want to be able to find, say, the equivalent of these C's and alphas on this slide. And that's something we're going to talk about, I think that'll be next week, that neural networks give you a way both of learning the linear weights and of choosing the values of the features. And of choosing the parameters for these feature functions. That's one way to think about what a neural network is. Okay, so that's pretty much all I have to say. So we've talked about models. We say a linear model. We've seen really that means a model that's linear in the parameters. And then we've seen an example of that is a linear regression or polynomial regression or radial basis functions. And we talked about how to do maximum likelihood, and we talked about overfitting. So, okay.